Well, good evening, everyone. My name's Robin Archer, and I'm the director of the Ralph Miliband program here at the London School of Economics. And I want to welcome you tonight to our special event on the American election. Our aim, in line with the remit of the Ralph Miliband program, is to examine the significance of this extraordinary event for the prospects for progressives, both in the United States and beyond. And to help us do that, we've got an absolutely wonderful panel. I'm going to just introduce them briefly, because there's three of them. I'll try and keep it short. Immediately next to me is Gary Gerstel, who's the Paul Mellon Professor of American History at the University of Cambridge. And his works deal with American social and political history with a particular focus, I think, on labour and class formation and on race, immigration and nationality. And amongst his best-known books are Working Class Americanism, American Crucible, The American Crucible, Race and Nation in 20th Century America, and just this year, Liberty and Coercion, The Paradox of American Government. At the far end of the table is Stephen Erlanger. Stephen is the London Bureau Chief for the New York Times. And in a 40-year career, since his earliest postings, he's been to so many places that I can't list them all, but he's been to Eastern Europe, to Southeast Asia, he's been a correspondent in Moscow, in Washington, in Berlin, in the Middle East, in Paris, and here too. And his journalism has won a number of major prizes, at least five that I counted, including a shared Pulitzer Prize about a decade ago. Then in the middle, we have Bonnie Greer, who's a playwright, a novelist, and a critic. Born in Chicago, she's lived in London, I think, for 30 years, is that right? And she's served on the boards of a number of central cultural institutions in this country, the British Museum, the Royal Opera, the London Film School, and now she's the Chancellor of Kingston University in London. Her books include Obama Music and her recent biography, A Parallel Life, and she's written, I think, something like eight plays, something like that, for both theatre, for radio, for television, and most recently some of you may have seen the Hotel Cerise, which is set in the period just before the current American election and was just until very recently playing at the Theatre Royal at Stratford.
And it called Trump.
It called Trump. Well, there you are. So that's where you go to find out what's going to happen. Just to explain what we're going to do, we're going to start with brief comments for about 10 minutes or so from each of the panellists, and then there's going to be a period of chair-led discussion. That means I'm going to ask them questions. And then after that, we're going to have a good chunk of time to open it up for you to engage in questions and discussions with our panel. So before we start, can I ask you to join me in welcoming our wonderful panel?
Good evening, everybody. It's always a privilege for me to come back to LSE. I was here for the young people in the room long before you were even a glimmer in your parents' eyes. 1974-75, I was here, spent a year studying here, and it helped me to imagine the career that I subsequently embraced as an intellectual and as a historian, and I've always wanted to come back and spend part of my career here. Obviously, I'm an American. And I now have the opportunity to do that. So it's a great privilege for me to come back. I want to thank Robin Archer. I want to thank the Miliband Lecture Series for the opportunity to do this. A good part of my year in 1974 and 75, I spent reading Ralph Miliband's theories on Marx and the state and the economy. So it all has a lot of meaning to me now. We have been through a seismic event, a political eruption. It's personally very emotional for me. I was predicting not a Trump victory, even though as I reviewed a lot of my writing over the last several months, last couple days, I looked at the writing and it said, this is pointing to a Trump victory. But I think emotionally I could not embrace that phenomenon, and I think a lot of Americans had similar sentiments. So even though our analysis was in many respects on the mark, our inability to imagine this event happening made it very difficult for us to predict what happened. One of the books that Robin mentioned of mine, American Crucible, Race and Nation in the 20th Century, my publisher is bringing out a new edition. This book was published in 2001, and the new chapter is on race and nation in the age of Obama. I'm not going to speak about that this evening. But I had, because of the tight deadline, I had to write the ending of this chapter before the election. And so I wrote it as a Trump defeat and a Hillary Clinton victory, knowing that I might have to rewrite this ending, and I'm spent today, and I will tomorrow and Friday, writing a new ending. So at the end, I will have two endings, and one will be the real ending, and the other ending will be the one I turn to when I need an inspiration for a different path that history might have taken. In my brief comments tonight, there's so many things to talk about in terms of what's happened, and it would be a mistake to try and do everything. So I want to focus on one theme, and that is understanding Donald Trump as an expression of a more general revolt against economic elites and the political elites to which they are connected. And here Trump is quite similar to Bernie Sanders, conveying a general but deeply felt conviction that the whole economic and political system is rigged against ordinary Americans. Bernie Sanders has not gotten nearly as much attention in this country as Trump has, but he ought to, because he had a major influence on this election. I'll have a few more things to say about him shortly. These sentiments, a sense that the economic and political system is rigged, is rooted in the financial crash of 2008, a global imbalance of supply and demand that continues to this day. Elites have recovered economically from that moment. Ordinary people have not. This is a global story. If you've been following Brexit, and I imagine most of you in this room have very closely, you can understand most of the essentials of the Trump phenomenon. They are similar sorts of events happening in two countries. But there is an aspect that is specific to the United States, owing to a major Supreme Court decision in 2010. This is the Supreme Court decision known as Citizens United. And what Citizens United did was to remove all limitations on monetary political giving to campaigns. Money, the court ruled in 2010, is like speech. And because the Bill of Rights protects free speech, it protects my right, even as a billionaire, to give candidates as much money as I would like to, because to control that money is to interfere with my ability to express my views freely and clearly. Money cannot be restricted. So the imbalance in the economy between rich and poor has flooded since 2010 into politics. The expectation was that money would flood into politics in ways that would favor the rich. This is not quite what happened, although this may still be the long-term result. Money did flood into politics to an unprecedented degree, but the billionaire class in America failed to coalesce around a candidate or two. Instead, they cohered around 8 to 10 candidates. Each billionaire had his I don't think there's a woman in there. Each billionaire had his favorite. Each kept their man or woman alive much longer than would otherwise have been the case. Often these were marginal, extreme, and strange men and women, not the billionaires, the candidates they were supporting, who would never get far in a general election. This parade of marginal candidates cost Mitt Romney the election in 2012. It was an election he should have won, and if the billionaire candidates had been cleared out ahead of time, I think he would have. Meanwhile, the spectacle of rogue billionaires showering tens of millions of dollars and sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars on marginal candidates made the whole political process begin to smell rancid. The Koch brothers, who you may have heard of, they're low profile now. In Europe, they would be the Koch brothers, K-O-C-H. They are the Koch brothers in the United States. They raised a war chest for 2016 of $900 million, $1 billion they were ready to spend on candidates. And then they ended up with a man they hate, Donald Trump, so they didn't spend it on him. You can ask me later what they spent that money on. But think of two brothers spending $1 billion on politics. What kind of democracy is that? Torrents of money, mockery of democracy. It engulfed everyone, including Hillary Clinton, with her $300,000 speeches and her ties to the Clinton Foundation while she was Secretary of State. This created a space for populists, for men of the people, to emerge. And two did, Donald Trump and Bernie Sanders. Bernie Sanders, one of the central planks of his campaign is that I, meaning Bernie, I'll be Bernie for the moment, I will accept no big money in my campaign at all. He refused to accept big donations. He raised an incredible $43 million with an average donation being $27 each. That's like 20 pounds each is the average donation. Donald Trump, I used to call him, I don't know if I still can, well, why not, the Rodney Dangerfield of the billionaire class. I've got billions. You can't buy me. You can buy all these other people, but you can't buy me because I've got all these billions and I don't need a billionaire's money to get where I want to go. Populists of the left and right have been demanding that the American system be unrigged from favoring the super wealthy, its playing field leveled to allow ordinary Americans a decent chance in economics and politics. This is fundamental to what happened in America. Of course, there is a super irony of a billionaire posing as a populist, but one can't study American politics and history, and I've been doing it for a long time, and survive without an appreciation of irony. Now, of course, there is an enormous difference between left and right populism, with Bernie Sanders representing left populism and Trump representing right populism. Right populism is what is known in Europe and England simply as populism. A would-be strong man or woman arouses the people, calls on them to take back their country from elites and foreigners. It has a progressive dimension in that it calls for the government to take care of the real people or the deserving people, meaning the true English or the true French, perhaps the true German, the true Hungarians. And it promises these people welfare, social security, jobs programs, other things that governments can deliver. But this populism also has an authoritarian and xenophobic side. It gathers up and amplifies class resentments and directs them to scapegoats, usually represented by foreigners and racial others present in this society. This is a pretty good description of Trumpism, his scapegoats, blacks, Mexicans, Muslims, and perhaps American Jews. Left populism is a form of proto-democratic socialism. Most Europeans don't believe there's such a thing as left populism, but there is in the United States. It originated with a man called William Jennings Bryan in the 1890s among poor farmers in the South and West, and reappeared among the industrial working classes of the 1930s during the great labor surge that fueled the New Deal. Bernie Sanders is their heir. His intervention has been an important and consequential, reinsertion of an important and consequential tradition in American politics. Sanders has demonstrated that this tradition still has life in the 21st century. If you want to find hope in this election season, this is where you will find it. And if you want something to worry about, as though you don't have enough things already, here it is. In past populist surges, the political system, the political parties, have usually domesticated the populist rebels as they got close to power. They have removed some of their raw radical edges. U.S. political parties are big constellations, each with many divergent interests. To enter the force field of a political party is to enter a world of give and take and of compromise. the forces of give and take and compromise are very powerful. That has not happened with Trump. We have the rhetoric of domestication, or normalization, as it's called, but not the reality. Rather than the GOP, the Republican Party, bending Trump to their will, he has bent the party to his will. Trumpism is becoming the new center of American politics, which means a right that had not been in American politics at all now becomes the right on this new spectrum. That may be unprecedented, and that may be the scariest element of his victory. Thank you.
I guess I'll use this podium. First of all, it's a great pleasure to be here. Thank you all for coming. It's a busy night, and I do it partly for the memory of Ralph Miliband, whose life itself was inspiring and interesting, and who had two kids who've done pretty well for themselves, but not well enough, perhaps. I have a bit of an apology to make, which is that I have to leave a little bit early, but it will be during the question time. I have an open public email. If there's something that you want to take up with me later, please feel free. I'm going to talk more about the left, I think, in general. In 2009, I was based in France before coming here, and I wrote that a specter was haunting Europe, and the specter was socialism's slow collapse. And in 2009, that very strange figure, Bernard-Henri Lévy, was asked whether the Socialist Party of France was dying. And he said, no, he said, it's already dead. And in some sense, of course, he was right, though it won as an opposition party in opposition to Sarkozy, who certainly deserved to lose. François Hollande may have killed it now for another long period. And it's not just the rivalries within the left that hurt it. It's the transformation of society. Socialism was the great ideology of the last century. It won, and we should be grateful for its victory. It gave us unions. It gave us decent pay, mostly. It gave us protections. It gave us social welfare. It created the atmosphere for better gender equality. But those were victories of the last century. And today, this is my argument, socialism has become conservative, and it's become defensive, and it's become complacent, and it's spending its time desperately trying to defend the victories of the last century rather than thinking very hard about what it's doing now. Tony Jute, who I admired very much, who was a scholar of many things, but including the French working class, wrote a very prescient essay about why the workers of France, particularly in the old coal mines near the Belgian border, near Calais, why they didn't vote left, why they were voting right, why were they voting for the National Front. And this is one of Marine Le Pen's great sources of support. It's not just Marseille in the south, it's Calais and the north. So why is it that a working class, and this, you know, long predates Trump, saw an answer in the far right and not in the left? And that, I think, has been the dilemma we've all been trying to grapple with, sometimes without seeing it very clearly, it seems to me. Gore Vidal, who was a great American essayist and satirist, and even novelist, by the way, used to say that actually in the United States there was only one political party. It was called the Property Party, and it had a left wing and a right wing. And this is part of the problem, it seems to me. I'm very struck by Brexit and Trump, partly because these two Anglo-Saxon countries, unlike continental Europe, have the highest levels of inequality, have the highest gaps between top pay and low pay, and have the weakest social safety nets. And I think what that has meant is a whole class of people, what Trump called the hidden white voter, but people who are supporting right-wing populism all over the continent. These people no longer see that society has anything to offer them without a sense of revolution and change. And part of the problem has been, and I think it's part of the problem with the Ed Miliband Labour Party, is that, as it was in France, I went to the Socialist Party University, the summer university, and I said to François Hollande then, who was not yet president, said, you know, the strangest thing here, I can't find a single worker. What I see are bureaucrats and school teachers. The only workers are cleaning the loos. And this has been part of the problem of the professionalism of the left. It's happened here, too, a bit. This is why you have this vacuum that UKIP filled. I don't know why they seem incapable of filling it beyond Brexit, but it's out there for somebody to take. The left has become, for many people, just another party of government, just another part of the property party. Professional, consensus, policy doesn't change very much except on the margins. If the left wins, it doesn't change anything very much. Just look at France. And I think this has been part of the great issue. And at the same time, we've had, at least to me, a tremendous industrial revolution that is happening under our feet. We haven't understood it completely. It's partly to do with globalization, but it's mostly to do with computers and robotics and information technology. In America, we are manufacturing a lot of things. That's not the problem. But we're manufacturing them with fewer and fewer people, and we don't know what to do with those people. We don't know how they're going to live, and their incomes have been stagnant. I mean, we've published very good figures during the campaign about what's happened to real incomes of middle-class Americans. And in real terms, they have been stagnant, essentially, for 30 years. So that the notion, this American dream, you know, because after all, in America, we like rich people. We don't hate them. So we kind of admire Trump because he's rich. We're very Weberian in America. People can't any longer have a union job and a little house and two cars and send their kids to college. The money isn't there. And people feel denied. They feel their future has been taken from them. They've been betrayed. They see their jobs going to Mexico, to China, or they think they see their jobs going to Mexico and China. It's not that they would work for that amount of money, nor do they want to pay $800 for an iPhone either. But there is a sense that the dream is betrayed, and their identities, because a lot of it is about identity, are being dissolved in the global stew. And a lot of this is about migration, right? The sense that other people are taking what should be theirs. And does the left have an answer for this? Does it really? I mean, this Labour Party won't talk about immigration. It's afraid to talk about it. And this is, I think, a tremendous problem. I mean, without going much into Jeremy Corbyn, I mean, I was at the last conference in Liverpool, and I spent quite a lot of time with Momentum. But all I could think of was, you know, that line from The Great Gatsby, so we beat on boats against the current, borne ceaselessly back into the past. The past didn't, you know, it was glorious, but it didn't work. It didn't work. It doesn't work now. So I think, really, the left has this enormous dilemma in front of it. you can blame Hillary Clinton for not being and not inspiring people. The election was actually very, very close. You can blame Cameron, certainly, for a crummy campaign. But in the end, the biggest problem is there is a whole class of people that used to vote left who are not voting left anymore, see no reason to vote left, who are voting right, who are anxious about their future, anxious about migration, anxious about their jobs, anxious about their identity. And until the left has a response to those anxieties, I think it will be marginalized. The only thing I would try to say in America is that our civil society, to me, is still very strong, that Congress is not completely made of idiots, the Supreme Court isn't either, and it is always easier, as the Democratic Party looks to itself, tries to decide what to do with the Bernie Sanders wing and the traditional wing, it's easier in opposition. It's a chance to clean out the Clintons, think again, and watch, I think, the inevitable promises of Donald Trump come to disappoint the very people who voted for him. Thank you.
So can you hear me from here? I want to read something from a, I guess the only word to describe her is a demagogue dictator expert. Her name is Masha Gessen. And I want to talk to you, this is about being alert to normalization, because I think this is more a present danger right now than anything. I'll begin with an imaginary speech. Thank you, my friends, thank you, thank you. We have lost, and this is the last day of my political career, so I will say what must be said. We are standing at the edge of the abyss. Our political system, our society, our country itself are in greater danger than at any time in the last century and a half. The president-elect has made his intentions clear, and it would be immoral to pretend otherwise. We must band together right now to defend the law, the institutions, and the ideals on which our country is based. That's the speech Hillary Clinton should have given as her concession speech. This is the one she gave. We must accept this result and then look to the future. Donald Trump is going to be our president. We owe him an open mind and the chance to lead. Our constitutional democracy enshrines the peaceful transfer of power. We don't just respect that, we cherish it. It also enshrines the rule of law, the principle that we are all equal in rights and dignity, freedom of worship and expression. We respect and cherish these values too, and we must defend them. Our president said, "The point, though, is that we all go forward with the presumption of good faith in our fellow citizens, because that presumption of good faith is essential to a vibrant and functioning democracy." Masha Gessen continues, "Similar refrains were heard from various members of the liberal commentariat, with Tom Friedman vowing, 'I am not going to try to make my president fail,' to Nick Kristof calling on the approximately 52% majority of voters who supported someone other than Donald Trump to, quote, give Trump a chance. From the politicians who have, even the politicians who have in the past appealed to the less establishment part of the Democratic electorate, sounded the same conciliatory note. Senator Elizabeth Warren promised to, quote, put aside our differences. Senator Bernie Sanders was only slightly more cautious, vowing to try to find the good in Trump, to the degree that Mr. Trump is serious about pursuing policies that improve the lives of working families in this country, I and other progressives are prepared to work with him. However well-intentioned, this talk assumes that Trump is prepared to find common ground with his many opponents, respect the institutions of government, and repudiate almost everything he has stood for during the campaign. In short, it is treating him as normal, as a normal politician. There has until now been little evidence of that. More dangerously, Clinton's and Obama's very civil passages, which ended in applause, seemed to close off alternative responses to his minority victory. It was not hard to be reminded of Neville Chamberlain's statement that we should seek by all means in our power to avoid war, by analyzing possible causes, by trying to remove them, by discussion in the spirit of collaboration and goodwill. Both Clinton's and Obama's phrases about the peaceful transfer of power concealed the omission of a call to action. The protesters who took the streets of New York, Los Angeles, and other American cities on Wednesday night last did not do it because of Clinton's speech, but in spite of it. One of the falsehoods in Hillary's speech was the implied equivalency between civil resistance and insurgency. This is an autocrat's favorite con, the explanation for the violent suppression of peaceful protests the world over. The second falsehood is the pretense that America is starting from scratch and its president-elect is a tabula rasa, or we need to proceed with an open mind. It was as though Donald Trump had not, in the course of his campaign, promised to deport U.S. citizens, promised to create a system of surveillance targets specifically at Muslim Americans, promised to build a wall on the border with Mexico, advocated war crimes, endorsed torture, and threatened to put Hillary Clinton in jail herself. It was as though those statements, and many more, could be written off as so much campaign hyperbole, and now the campaign was over, Trump would be eager to become a regular, rule-abiding politician of the pre-Trump era. But Trump is anything but a regular politician, and this has been anything but a regular election. Trump will be only the fourth candidate in history and the second in more than a century to win the presidency after losing the popular vote. He is also probably the first candidate in history to win the presidency despite having been shown repeatedly by the national media to be a chronic liar, a sexual predator, a serial tax avoider, a race baiter who has attracted the likes of the Ku Klux Klan, and most important, Trump is the first candidate in memory who ran not for president but for autocrat, and he won. Listen to everything Trump has said. He has no political establishment in which to fold himself in following the campaign, and therefore no reason to shed his campaign rhetoric. On the contrary, it is now the establishment that is rushing to accommodate him, from the president, who met with him at the White House on Thursday, to the leaders of the Republican Party, who are discarding their long-held scruples to embrace his radical policies. He has received the support he needed to win and the adulation he craves precisely because of his outrageous threats. Trump's rally cry were "lock her up," and they meant it. If Trump does not go after Hillary Clinton on his first day in office, if he instead focuses, as his acceptance speech indicated he might, on the unifying project of investing in infrastructure, which now coincidentally would provide an instant opportunity to reward his cronies, it would be foolish to breathe a sigh of relief. Trump has made his plans clear, and he has made a compact with his voters to carry them out. These plans include not only dismantling legislation, but also doing away with judicial restraint and, yes, punishing his opponents. The national press is likely to be among the first institutional victims of Trumpism. There is no law that requires the presidential administration to hold daily briefings, none that guarantees media access to the White House. Many journalists may soon face a dilemma long familiar to those of us who worked on autocracies: fall in line or forfeit access. There is no good solution, even if there is a right answer, for journalism is difficult and sometimes impossible without access. The power of the investigative press, whose adherence to fact has already been severely challenged by the conspiracy-minded, lie-spinning Trump campaign, will grow weaker. The world will grow murkier. Even in the unlikely event that some mainstream media outlets decide to declare themselves in opposition to the current government or even simply to report its abuses and failings, the president will get to frame the issues. Coverage and thinking will drift in a Trumpian direction, just as it did during the campaign, when, for example, the candidates argued, in essence, whether Muslim Americans bear collective responsibility for acts of terrorism or can redeem themselves by becoming the eyes and ears of law enforcement. Thus, xenophobia was normalized, paving the way for Trump to make good on his promises to track American Muslims and ban American Muslims from entering the United States. What we must do on the left is be outraged in the face of this impulse to normalize. It is essential to maintain our capacity for not only shock, but to be shocked. This will lead people to call you unreasonable and hysterical and to accuse you of overreacting. This is what they do in dictatorships, so be prepared. Despite losing the popular vote, Trump has secured as much power as any American leader in history. The Republican Party controls both houses of Congress. There's a vacancy on the Supreme Court. The country is at war abroad and has been in a state of mobilization for 15 years. This means not only that Trump will be able to move fast, but also that he will become accustomed to an unusually high level of political support. He will want to maintain and increase it. His ideal is that totalitarian-level popularity numbers of Vladimir Putin. And the way to achieve that is through mobilization. There will be more wars abroad and at home. What she urges us on the left to do is do not compromise. Don't become like Ted Cruz, who made the journey all the way to, oh, okay, I'll endorse him. The other thing is we must remember the future. Nothing lasts forever. Trump certainly will not, since he's the oldest person ever to be president. So to the extent that it is centered on Trump's persona, he won't last either. Failure and our failure to imagine the future is what lost the Democrats the election. They offered no future to counterbalance Trump's all-too-familiar white populist vision of the American past. And I'm going to stress that because this election was a backlash. And anybody who talks about it in any other way isn't giving you the whole deal. This was a backlash, just like Brexit. They had also long ignored the strange and outdated institutions of American democracy that call out for reform, like the Electoral College, which has now cost the Democratic Party two elections in which Republicans won with the minority of the popular vote. That is not normal. But resistance, stubborn, uncompromising, outrage, pissed off resistance is what should be normal. And I want to read one more thing from a man named Richard Rorty, who wrote in a book, he's a philosopher, who wrote in a book called Achieving Our Country in 1998. This is his quote. Members of labor unions and unorganized, unskilled workers will sooner or later realize that their government is not even trying to prevent wages from sinking or to prevent jobs from being exported. Around the same time, they will realize that suburban white-collar workers, themselves desperately afraid of being downsized, are not going to let themselves be taxed to provide social benefits for anybody else. At that point, something will crack. The non-suburban electorate will decide that the system has failed and start looking around for a strong man to vote for, someone willing to assure them that once he is elected, the smug bureaucrats, the tricky lawyers, the overpaid bond salesmen, and the postmodernist professors will no longer be calling the shots. One thing that is very likely to happen is that the gains made in the past 40 years by black people, by brown people, by homosexuals, by women will be wiped out. Jocular contempt for women will come back into fashion. All the resentment which badly educated Americans feel about having their manners dictated to them by college graduates will find an outlet. And the next line after this, he wrote, after my imagined strong man takes charge, he will quickly make his peace with the international super rich. And it was announced today that Trump is looking at Jamie Dimon to head up his treasury. Rorty ends by saying what we should do as the left is to mobilize, and mobilize based on what remains of our pride in being Americans. Thank you.
Well, thank you all three very, very much for those extremely interesting and provocative comments. I'm just going to start by asking a question to each of our panellists, and I'm going to start in the order that they spoke. So first to Professor Gerstle. I mean, thinking about it from the point of view of the left, it's clear that this is going to create some kind of realignment, and the pieces are going to come down in one or another form on the left side. And I wanted to ask you, what kind of allies do you think should be the basis for that realignment? Should it be a kind of liberal popular front against the kind of xenophobic and authoritarian forces that Trump represents, in a sense modelled on a kind of 1930s situation? Or should it, as seemed implicit in your comments, be a kind of left populist alliance in which opposition to trade agreements and so on would come to the fore? Is there a way in which you can think about how that should work out?
Well, I do think we're in uncharted territory here, and I think there's only so much we can draw from the past to understand the future. The more I think about it, the more I believe that 2008 will come to be seen as a pivot in world history. I think we're passing out of an era of globalization, commitment to free trade, free movement of people, cosmopolitanism. And what's happening in the U.S. Is part of that moment. I share Stephen Erlanger's sense of the inability of socialism, in a sense, to rise to the moment. A sense of exhaustion, a sense of implication in what has been a neoliberal order. I take heart from the fact, and here the United States is somewhat out of step with Europe, young people calling me up wanting to talk to me about socialism. I actually happen to know a lot about American socialism because I spent a lot of years studying it and ultimately came to the conclusion that no socialist could ever be elected president of the United States, and I have these 20-year-olds telling me, what are you talking about? It's going to happen this year. One of the encouraging developments is socialism no longer carries the serious stigma that it did during the Cold War. And related to that, as an encouraging part of this moment, is that it is now possible to imagine new forms of left politics taking shape, freed from the burden of communism, because there's no real communism left in the world, and no one pretends that there is, even in North Korea or China. No one pretends that communism exists. And so this allows us to imagine not just right populism triumphing, but a new kind of left-wing politics. Will it be more populist than socialist? It's hard to say. I have Europeans and British people tell me, well, what you have in America is not socialism. Bernie Sanders, everyone knows, is not a socialist. And my retort to that is, well, what is a socialist? We no longer know. And if a left is going to have influence and purchase in the 21st century world, then defining socialism is going to have to be central to that project. Another encouraging sign and something very positive to come out, not of 2008 directly, the issue of economic inequality is on the American political agenda in the way it has not been for 70 years, or longer actually, since the New Deal, since the 1930s. The movement that put this back on the map was Occupy Wall Street, a movement that I tended to dismiss at the time because there weren't really a lot of people occupying that Zuccotti Park near Wall Street, and I said, how do they compare to the great heroes of the civil rights movement and the great heroes of the labor movement of the 30s when they were turning out hundreds of thousands of people and in the 1930s, millions of people joining unions, except that Occupy Wall Street and its sister and brother organizations in Europe and the Middle East, although in the Middle East it's been defeated, Tahrir Square, did change the discourse in a very profound way and put inequality back at the center of American politics. As we have seen with Trump and also in terms of rising populisms in Europe, that issue of inequality can be captured by the right. But Bernie Sanders has shown that there's an opportunity for the left to rebirth itself around that issue in some kind of progressive coalition.
Okay, thank you. So now to Stephen. I mean, one of the points you made was that this was a general English-speaking phenomenon. And indeed, I took it that it was partly a global phenomenon. It was to do with things like technological change and the extent of globalization. But I just want to quiz you about that a little further. I mean, how global really is it? I mean, it's clear that Trump has a bit of a love-in, he likes Putin. But, of course, Putin is an authoritarian for reasons quite unconnected to the developments that gave rise to Trump. China is another story again. It's true that Brexit and Trump share something, but even in the English-speaking world, there's Canada, which seems to be quite different, really. So is it really a global phenomenon, and to what extent is it?
I'm one of these people who actually don't believe in global phenomena. You just have to spend a week in China to know you're somewhere else. People think differently. We like to pretend we have universal values. We don't. There are lots of people in the world who have different values, and they express them quite articulately and forcefully. What I meant by Anglo-Saxon was the nature of our economies and the way politics is expressed through them. Canada is much more of a European-style system. I mean, it has healthcare, it has national healthcare, it has good protections. Canadians are really nice. I tease Canadian friends and say they're decaffeinated Americans. Some of them are proud of that, actually. Some of them get offended by it. So what I was trying to make the point was really more about how savage our capitalisms are compared to other places. And I think the more savage the capitalism, the more risky the populism. Having spent a lot of time on the continent, one can be wrong about everything. Like Gary, I was wrong about Trump. I really didn't believe Hillary Clinton could lose to this guy. She could lose to a lot of people, but not to this guy. Yeah. I don't think Marine Le Pen is going to become president of France, for instance. I mean, for two real reasons. One, they're used to her. She's not a new phenomenon. They've priced her in to some degree. I mean, her stock's gone up a bit, but there's also a very strong Republican front against the National Front that I think will persist.
The system, yeah.
Yeah, and if it's Juppé, which it may be, you know, I'm not really worried. If it's Sarkozy, I'm a little more worried. But I just think it's different. It's different on the in Germany, I'm far less worried. The AfD actually began as an anti-Euro phenomenon. It was against the currency. And then it's kind of swung into anti-excess immigration. But again, you have Die Linke on the left, which is what's left of a communist party, which is really a sort of left-wing populist party, and the AfD. I mean, you have the disintegration or the diminution of old Christian Democrat parties all over the continent. They're getting smaller, which means coalitions are a lot harder to build, and you get more fragmentation. And that's by itself a problem. But I don't think you have a majority as we found in America for this kind of anger.
Okay, thank
that
you.
Helps.
I agree with that.
And to Bonnie, I mean, your central thesis was about resisting normalisation, and you gave a strong argument about why it was important to resist normalisation. I wanted you to say a little bit more about how one might resist normalisation. I mean, implicit in what you said, but I might be wrong, was that there was a need for some kind of social movement or organisation outside the electoral process. And I just simply observe that what goes as a movement often, I mean, including left-wing movements like the Bernie Sanders movement or the Corbyn movement, is actually a kind of a rally around a political leader rather than an organisation built on separate autonomous bases. So where would you look for the, you know, what the CIO was to, you know, where's the autonomous movement? Or how do you actually engage in this resistance?
Well, first of all, I was asked to be on the BBC. Remember, the media is going to be the first toward normalization. There was something that the head of CBS said during the campaign. Trump may not be good for the American people, but he's damn good for CBS. And so the media will be moving toward normalization because they need our eyeballs, they need our clicks. So I was asked, actually, to be on, go on the BBC with a man named Raheem Kassam, who is head of Breitbart London, and I refused. And the next thing I did, as soon as I said I wasn't going to go on with Raheem, I went online and I tweeted it as fast as I could. What that did, of course, was get people around this tweet. It was an electronic digital activism where people began to then look at Breitbart and look at that, look at the site, look at not only Breitbart London, but Breitbart, because it is a leader of what's called the alternative right, which has some of the most violent stuff you've ever seen. How do you mobilize around that? Oh, the other thing, too, and I'm glad you brought this up, Robin, that we have had movements coalesced by around men, whether they're on the left or whether they're on the right. That's something we should be very careful about and we should be wary of. That's another normalization thing that I want to flag up. I look to young people. I don't know what they're going to do. I like Black Lives Matter, what I understand about it. I like Not My President. I like what a lot of millennials are doing. I don't know what you make out of that. My generation was the anti-Vietnam War, and we actually coalesced behind a Bernie Sanders figure, Eugene McCarthy, and we got Richard Nixon. So I would urge people that this time, with the tools that we have, to try and see if we can make a multifaceted, multi-headed, or multi-peopled movement. I don't know how to do that. But I know that we have to move away from the lone ranger who will save you from it all. And we have to find another way. I don't know how to do that, but I think the coming generations do know how to do that.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you very much indeed. So now we move to the period where we're open to questions and discussion from the floor. I think I might take questions in groups, and obviously we're not going to be able to answer every single question with every single person, so it might be that I have to sort of allocate people if we get quite a lot. But can I just start, the woman with the glasses there. Now, could you say, wait for the microphone, say who you are and where you're from, if that's relevant.
My name's Jocelyn. I think it's really key in terms of what Bonnie said. I think it's really important to look at mobilisation. And when we think that, in England, for example, nearly 2 million of us mobilised against the war in Iraq, and that was a coalition of different forces. It was the first time in my lifetime I've been on a demonstration with Muslims, lesbians and gays, and a whole plethora of different organizations marching together. But my concern is that at this juncture, we don't have a way to access information to people. People do not know half of what is going on. And we don't have access to the media. We don't have control of the media. How the hell do we get across to people that there are other alternatives, that it is possible to have another vision, that we can build a better, more compassionate society?
Okay, can we just hold that for a minute, and I'll just take a couple of others. So the gentleman there with the green hat, please, and then the person in the middle up the top.
I'm Dr. Keith Postler, affiliated to the LSE. Multinationals have budgets far bigger than the majority of nations. How can the left cope with that?
Okay, thank you very much. That's an excellent, succinct question. And the person...
In terms of sort of political concepts and political language, I don't know if it's a legacy of the Cold War, but we still talk a lot of the rhetoric is about, you know, the left, the right. Are you a socialist? Are you a conservative? Are you a social democrat? Do you think that this paradigm now, or these particular terms now with the rise of Trump and what we're seeing, do you think that they help the political discussion, or do they hinder it?
Okay, thank you. Bonnie, would you address the first question possibly about the mobilization?
Well, that's the hardest one.
That's your baby.
I don't know. You know, I think the first, you know, I'll give you a Zen answer. The answer lies in the question, in the sense that if we recognize that there is a problem, there is a crisis, then I believe that we can, if we work on the crisis, we can find the answer within it. It is possible to work under the radar. It is possible to communicate offline. It is possible to do that. But the means of production are not in our hands, and the means of production are actually going to go out of the hands of the mainstream media as well if we're not careful. I don't know if people know, but Donald Trump banned the Washington Post from his campaign trail. This is the Washington Post, and lied about the New York Times continuously. In fact, the Times had to come and do something it's never done, which is actually publish a lawyer's letter in order to defend itself against the stuff he's saying. So what I'm saying is maybe we can get people who understand and know the media to maybe find ways to conduit to them to figure out how to do this, but it has to be done.
Okay. And Stephen, I don't know, you're a globe-trotting journalist. Maybe on multinationals you might have something to say, the power of big business.
Well, that's why we have the tax system. And that's why we have politics. And that's why people have to organize and be part of politics. And if they want to change society, they have to do it.
They can't just
yak about it.
Gotta get in it.
I mean, just one thing that fascinates me, a lot of my friends in America, particularly women, are getting very much involved with what they're calling the
Million Women March.
Million Women March, and they want to march on Washington.
It's going to be here in London, too, by the way. Yeah.
During inauguration, just to show their anger or unhappiness or whatever at the prospect of this man in the White House. And that's important. I mean, I grew up also during the tension of the Vietnam War, and then we really had a divided society. Then people were screaming at each other, and people were killing each other, and Kent State didn't come from nothing, right?
That's right.
And we're not there yet, but the potential is there. We're a very divided society, and social media makes us more aggressive. I think it's a bit like cheap vodka. And what worries me is, you know, I was thinking about this. Everyone criticized Trump for his tweet madness in the middle of the night. In fact, he was very effective.
post.
I mean, all politicians are looking to overcome the filters they perceive between them and their people, and to avoid the media, to avoid the experts, to just talk directly to the believers. And he did that very effectively. And it reminded me, maybe this is too extreme, of the way Hitler, when he was campaigning, used the radio, this newfangled thing called the radio, to communicate directly with the people of Germany and his followers. He used rallies.
And planes.
He was one of the first politicians to fly from place to place, and he used the radio. So this is the new radio, and it's changed politics, and I think it will change politics. And I fully expect, like Berlusconi, Trump's going to be phoning up the news programs from the White House and saying, I don't like that story, and I'm the president, right? Because he can't stop himself, and it'll be very interesting. Sorry.
No, thank you. So about the political language, is it useful to continue talking in terms of left and right?
Yes, but let me first tear up the script a little bit and just say a couple of things about the other questions. First, Black Lives Matter and Bernie Sanders came out of nowhere. They didn't literally come out of nowhere, but when they emerged, they were a tremendous surprise. This is about youth. Well, not Bernie, but
sort of is
his supporters. It's about imagination, and it's about the contingency of events. In the United States, major social change has always required some kind of social movement outside of conventional politics. Wherever you look for major change, whether it's the women's movement or the labor movement or the civil rights movement, that is going to happen again. I have great faith in the capacity of new social movements to be born. It's not going to be done by, well, maybe you, Robin, anyone on this panel.
No,
it's going to be done by the young.
By you.
And the imagination, and it will happen. Mm-hmm. This Million Woman March, scheduled for the day after the inauguration, is another example. The seven women, including my two young nieces in Seattle, have already signed up, 9 and 12, to go to this march. There are going to be a million women in Washington, D.C. the day after the inauguration. There are also a number of cities declaring themselves to be sanctuary cities in case there are broad roundups of people. New York State is contemplating becoming a sanctuary state.
California is too, I think.
Andrew Cuomo is no radical. Mm-hmm. You can be sure of that. Mm-hmm. So there's going to be resistance on multiple fronts. It has to happen. It has to be an urgency. And I share your sentiment entirely about resisting normalization and even being outraged at efforts to promote normalization. On the multinational question, this in some ways is the biggest problem we face, because the nation state was the big redistributor of property. And as long as corporations were mostly national, national legislatures can do this. Now most corporations are multinational and national legislatures don't work. This is the problem of the EU. For the EU really to work and solve its democratic deficit, you need a European Parliament, a real European Parliament. That's probably never going to happen. So that is, and talk about much more important than labels, inventing some kind of mechanism that's going to solve that problem is probably the biggest challenge politics, especially left politics, faces. What you need is a sovereign parliament larger than national parliaments to address these issues, and we just don't know how to get there. In terms of labels, I think left and right are going to remain relevant categories. The content of them will change, and we really have to. I think we have to. We should be asking the question: What does socialism mean in the 21st century world? The Labor Party should be asking this question, and they're not. What does it mean? How does it work? And then you decide whether the label is still useful or whether you feel you need to invent another one. Momentum's not going to do it. I can tell you that.
No, because they're throwbacks, actually, and they don't know it.
Right. But even the label, Momentum, is not going to work.
Yeah, it's a giveaway. Can I just add something quickly that I noticed something in 2008. One of the things that's interesting about being an immigrant or expat American is that you can actually step back and look at stuff and think, why don't people notice this is happening? When the crash happened, it seemed to me that capital in the United States began to consolidate quite quickly and become more visible than it ever did before. In terms of, you have your Donald Trumps in the golden chair, you have millennial heirs and heiresses who are worth trillions of dollars, suddenly began to flaunt this stuff, which was interesting to me. I'd never actually seen that level of flaunting before, and I'm not quite sure what propelled it to happen, because you would think the opposite thing would happen because the crash, but the other thing happened. The other thing that I noticed as well, the generation of people who benefited from the civil rights movement and the women's movement, people who went to university in 2000 and went to university in 1980, in the 80s, like the Obamas and so forth, suddenly began to become a class themselves. And this class was a class of Harvard, MIT, so-and-so, who became a kind of class and began to take over the commentariat, began to take over the politics, began to take over the fashion, the films, the culture. That's interesting to me. And this is I'm a baby boomer, so I'm old enough to have watched this group of people come on stream and take advantage of a lot of struggle that people in my generation earlier made. But I'm not looking at the give back, and maybe they don't know they should give back. And I'm not talking about people who are not giving public service, but I'm looking at a generational, I was going to say selfishness, but I don't mean that, a generation that considered itself to be talking to itself and necessary to itself and owed no one anything. And they're running the show in many ways right now. And I think they forgot the past. They just forgot it.
Okay, let's take a new round of questions. Can we start with the gentleman in the edge of the thing up there?
So it must make sense to one or two of them. So.
First and foremost, I wanted to say that this topic is especially poignant for me as a Black American who's also a member of the LGBT community. And I want to say that as a person that's lived here for a few weeks, in Britain, I have felt more human in this country than I've ever felt in my own country. But I'd also like to offer that the current narrative that says that there were these disaffected white people that were basically ignored by politicians is a completely insufficient explanation. It belies the facts of identity politics throughout the history of the United States. It ignores the history of Jim Crow. It also ignores the fact that even in as recently as 2004, Republicans used gay marriage as a wedge issue that ultimately allowed George W. Bush to get reelected. I think that it's important to take a look at the Black Lives Matter movement, which for myself and some of the other black people who sort of looked at each other when someone said that they didn't see that coming. It was coming, and we were aware of it. Trump, literally the day that President Obama got elected, my friends and I said to ourselves, white people are going to go crazy, either in 4 years or 8 years. Trump was an absolute inevitability. And it's one thing to say that there are these disaffected voters. It's another thing to acknowledge the fact that along with being disaffected, that there is a connection, a strong connection of race and perceptions about the economy. When you lose your job and you then say that black person or that brown person is the reason why I no longer have a job. Yet that person who's lost their job and was affected by Reaganomics, who then became worse off under George W. Bush, but they're still supporting Republicans. And then now that you have a gentleman in the name of Trump, who was best known in my country for you're fired, is somehow going to be the answer to your not having a job. For me, those two things don't add up. So I just wanted to, the question is whether and the current explanation in terms of them being disaffected is truly an insufficient one.
Okay, thank you. Let's just hold that now. There's a woman in the back row up there.
Hello. my question is if this nationalist movement, this movement towards the right that we're seeing across much of the West, if that is going to be a true threat to democratic institutions, something that we've seen in Poland amongst other countries.
Okay, thank you very much. And this gentleman with the tie in the third or fourth row.
Thank you. Traditionally, in terms of class politics, the left had, if you like, class identity on its side, because class is primarily about economics. What we've seen in recent decades is this inversion of class politics, where it's become more about culture, in the sense that the elites look down on the people, using their rhetoric, the real people's their way of life, their concerns. And the notion now that the elites are not the economic elites, but they're in the media, they're in academia, and so on. How does the left begin to deal with this? And also, just to say briefly to Gary Gersel, I've tried to get people to come out to vote in European elections, and we are a very long way from the European Parliament being the parliament that you want it to be, unfortunately.
Okay, now I think I'll just start with Stephen. There's been three questions. Don't try to answer them all. One about backlash, one about threat to democracy, and this last one about class politics.
I wanted to answer you, first of all, which is to say you put your question very well, and I don't disagree with you. I mean, I did try to say identity was a big part of the disaffection, as Tim Bale, who's quite a good political scientist in this country, said to me in a story I did about Brexit and Trump, you know, it's not the economy, stupid, it's identity. And so your point is extremely well taken. And your point about racism, which is the point you were making, which was part of the reaction to Obama, is also well worth making. And the sexism that was a reaction to Hillary Clinton was also out there and real.
Yep.
I still think the election was winnable, you know, and part of the problem I always felt, you know, I've met Hillary Clinton, I admire Hillary Clinton. I mean, she was a terrible candidate, and even I couldn't really tell you what she truly wanted to do as President of the United States, other than become President of the United States, which is a noble goal. And one thing I do know is it's very hard to predict what Donald Trump's going to do, because he doesn't know either. Because he never expected to win. And so they're all rather taken by surprise. So, I mean, I thank you for what you said, and I really don't disagree with what you said at all. I think it's an important corrective. In terms of the left, look, I mean, you know, I'm not a great prophet. It just seems to me that the left is supposed to represent, I wouldn't say real people, we're all real, but people who are disadvantaged, who are having struggles, who are not part of this new elite. And it has to do that effectively by listening to those people, which it has not been doing. If the elite has been deaf to real concerns of ordinary people, so has the left. And the left is, as what I tried to argue, has become a kind of elite of its own, to itself. I mean, very self-satisfied, I have to say, you know, about the environment and about gender equality and about all these wonderful things, and they are wonderful, but they have produced a backlash. And rather than patronizing or ignoring the people who are upset by them, I think it's important not to go backwards, but to understand what the backlash is about and try to deal with it and cope with it, and also have, you know, frankly, a more representative left that includes some of these people who are really tempted to go to UKIP or to vote for Theresa May. I mean, otherwise it's going to be another long period, I'm afraid, out in the very safe, wonderful place where you can criticize everything and are responsible for nothing. And having said that, you have to forgive me. I've got to run. It's been a great pleasure. Please continue and...
Can I just say quickly that the reason that we don't talk about this as a backlash shows you that the lack of control and voice in the media, because people aren't doing that, okay? This was a backlash in the classic old-fashioned, 100% gold-plated, you know, reading the history books. If you look at the people and look at a lot of the stats in relation to who voted, it was a backlash. And I agree with you in that in 2008, I said the same thing. Oh, my God, they elected this man. Hell will be paid. And I think that what we, if we don't bring in the narrative of color, if we don't bring it in here, we won't get this, okay? Because part of what is going on in the United Kingdom right now, they won, leave won based on immigration. It was about immigration. You can say it was anything else. You can say, oh, it was going to be $350 million to the NHS, which was the other thing. BS. It was about immigration. The struggle that's going on now, and we need to talk about this, the world is becoming browner. It's changing. It's changing. Nothing is going to stop it. Now, I won't be around when it changes, but it is. You can look at the demographics. You can look at any kind of stats you want. That's what's going down. And if you dig into the sort of Marine Le Pen, Geert Wilders, UKIP, Trump, you get down into the weeds and you see that's what's fueling all of this. There are people in the United States who voted for Trump because they didn't want to see this black man. They wanted to get back at him. They said it. They said it. They didn't hide it. They said it. Now, until the left comes to grips with the fact that we do have this issue, that it is, we can heal it, we can heal it, but we can't until we face it. If we walk around it, if we talk around it, if we go around talking about other stuff, I'm sorry, as someone said, oh, if you're white working class, and you're losing your wages, is your reaction to scream out of your window packy? No, it isn't. That isn't the way it works. That is not about what the white working class is about. This is something else, and we really need to come together and talk about and look at it, because it's not going to go away. It's here to stay.
I agree with that. The United States will be a majority-minority country by 2050, which means a majority of the people living in the United States will be members of groups currently considered minorities. A majority of people will be descended from people whose origins do not lie in Europe for the first time in American history. Obama is seen as being a transitional figure to that future, and part of the referendum of this election was to reject that future, even though the demographics are baked in, can't be changed, right. Which also makes the vote more hysterical, because you can't, in fact, change it. And what I mean by that is, even if Trump deports 11 million Mexicans,
can't stop it.
This demographic date with destiny is going to happen. It can't be changed, and there's a desperation about that in white communities, because they understand that something is happening that can't be stopped. A lot of white Americans do not want a black man in the White House. It's as simple as that. And they're going to try and erase him.
As fast as they can.
By erasing his legislation. And this issue is going to have to be fought over frontally. A couple other comments. the democracy question. I think democracy is on the defensive in Europe and the United States. I can't say it reminds me of the 1930s because I'm not that old. I wasn't alive then. But I've studied the 1930s, and the discourse is similar, that democracies are inefficient, they can't solve problems, they can't get the job done, and what you need are strong men to take decisive action to solve problems that democracies can't do. The numbers of democracies in the world in the 1930s were down to single digits, count them on both hands. And we're not down to single digits, but my sense is that one of the reasons that Putin is so excited about Trump is he thinks he's got a fellow strongman, Erdogan, Modi in India, leaders of Hungary and other places like that. There is a front taking shape that in its essence is anti-democratic. And that's one reason why it's so important for Europe to make democracy work, and this is what makes the dilemma of not having full democracy in Europe such a serious problem. I am under no illusions about a European Parliament coming tomorrow, but there has got to be some kind of solution to this, because a lot is now going to ride on Europe in terms of being a beacon of democracy to the world. The inversion of class identity. When I came to the LSE in 1974-75, I came to read the British labor historians, E.P. Thompson, Eric Hobsbawm, Gareth Stedman Jones, teach me about class in the United States, and then I went off to write about class in the 1930s, the rise of the labor movement. They gave me what I needed to write about the history of class in the 1930s. They are not a guide to the post-industrial world in which we live. And I have just convened a workshop, a study group, which is an admission of ignorance on my part, that I don't understand how class works in post-industrial society, and that we better figure it out, because otherwise things are going to happen to us that surprise us and that we don't understand. And it has to be part of the understanding class is the connecting class and identity in ways that we have so far, and culture in ways that we haven't yet successfully done.
Yes.
Okay. Well, I fear that we are at 7:55, and I think it would be unwise to start a new round of questions given that, which is unfortunate. I want to thank all three of our panelists for some extremely thoughtful comments and responses. I mean, I think we've heard that it's a very serious situation. I mean, these last comments really underline that, where institutions which we take for granted may be up for grabs. And yet at the same time, there's been a suggestion that we maintaining some sort of outrage at this normalisation is a way forward, and that change is possible, and that it comes through social movement organisation, and that that movement organisation, or so our panellists have suggested, can be found amongst young people and their imaginative world. So thank you all very much for coming.
Thank you
to our...